and welcome to a very exciting, kind of random, but very intimate episode of Breakfast All Day. It's just me and Alonzo today. I'm Christy, and this is Alonzo.
I'm Alonzo, and it's audio only this week.
It's audio only. Matt's not here, and Matt's the one who usually shoots the video.
Yes.
And like, knows how to do that. I mean, I guess we could figure it out.
We'll have to have a tutorial at some point. But also, as you can probably tell from my voice, I've been battling allergies all week. So I'm sure my nose has been rubbed raw by thousands of Kleenexes. So it's just as well you're not seeing me this week.
He's still adorable, you guys.
No,
he's still his handsome, cuddly self. So we've got a really random mixed bag of movies. There's no one single giant film opening this week like we had last week with Captain Marvel. So it's kind of a mixed bag.
And we skipped a lot of the, at least I did, a lot of the big movies this week, like 5 Feet Apart, right, and Captive State.
Right. I have seen 5 Feet Apart, and perhaps we can play catch up with that if you have to for any reason.
Maybe.
Maybe you do. I would like to catch up with The Mustang if we can, maybe
okay,
next week, because I think it's excellent. And I get to do a Q&A tonight with the hunky Matthias Schoenaerts.
Lucky.
So that'll be fun. Well, come hang out with us at the Landmark tonight.
Oh, don't think I won't.
The 7 o'clock showing where we're going to chat afterward.
I can fulfill my lifelong dream of coughing near him.
He'll be touched by that too. So we're gonna jump around a bit here. We're going to start today with a film that is on Netflix, and I think it's also had a quick little theatrical run.
About a week run in theaters in L.A., which again, it's the ongoing Netflix thing with their whole battle about do they qualify for Oscars or not. Technically, they are following the rules for movies that have to be considered for Oscars, which is they run for a week theatrically in New York and Los Angeles before being available on the service. And I mean, sometimes I guess it's coinciding with the premiere on the service. But in this case, yeah, they opened it on the 6th and then it launched on Netflix on the 13th.
It's called Triple Frontier. It's got a massive all-star cast and a very impressive director. Tell us about it, Alonzo.
So, yeah, it's the latest film from J.C. Shandor, who is one of my favorite working filmmakers right now. He started off a very impressive career with 3 in a row, Margin Call.
All Is Lost.
All Is Lost, thank you. I
was reading
that.
It's the second one.
Love that movie. That's like my favorite of his movies. I can never remember the title. And a Most Violent Year. This one is maybe not quite up to those standards.
No.
It is co-written by Shandor and Mark Bowell, who wrote Zero Dark Thirty. And yeah, it stars Ben Affleck and Oscar Isaac and Charlie Hunnam and Garrett Hedlund and Pablo Pascal. They play 5 retired soldiers who decide to, do one last job. It's
the tried and true one last job.
Exactly. And so Oscar Isaac's character talks them into, at first, what just sounds like, capturing a bad drug lord. And then it turns out, no, we're really just going to rob all of his money. But they're okay with that, and they go ahead and do it anyway. But, of course, things don't go as planned. So, it's one of those heist movies where things don't go as planned. And it has some things to say about, how crappy we treat our veterans and how it's when you create a warrior, that's the thing you can't just turn off and send them back into, civilian life. But ultimately, I didn't think any of these characters were existed beyond their sort of outline, which is disappointing because I think in Shandor's work, the stories might fit into a certain genre, but the characters he creates are really interesting and rich, even in All Is Lost, which has virtually no dialogue.
Especially in All Is Lost.
Yeah.
You have Redford on screen for the entirety of the film, and that is it. Redford stranded on a boat, and
yeah,
you have a deep sense of who this man was and is.
Absolutely.
Every moment of that, right. So this was a weird project. This has been kicking around for a while, and originally Kathryn Bigelow was supposed to direct.
Oh, interesting.
And she is an executive producer alongside Mark Bull. Of course, she directed The Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty, both Mark Bull scripts.
And Detroit, I believe he also.
Did he also write that?
Yeah.
And this, it falls into that same pattern of films and themes that he's explored in the past as far as you say, the way that, military and veterans aren't treated with the thoroughness and kindness that they deserve and the difficulty of readjusting to civilian life. And there is a cynical approach to the sensation of patriotism. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to be a patriot? And he often asks really smart questions about all of these topics.
You know, are certain actions justified when done for flag and country as opposed to other purposes, or are they always a bad idea?
Right.
You know?
But those previous films really are more character studies, and that's really what is missing here.
Yeah.
This is more of a straight up action movie, and there's really not a whole lot to any of these characters. Even Oscar Isaac, who is the Danny Ocean of it,
right,
if you will.
He's
the one who rounds up all the guys for one last job. You don't really know a whole lot about him beyond the fact that he's clearly a badass and he's seen some shit.
Yes.
And he's exceedingly capable and a strong leader. That's all you know. But what was that life like before? What might that life be like after? And there's no sense of that. The one of the five characters we get the best sense of is Ben Affleck as... he was like, what, the former like logistics guy on this team,
But I think also like the commanding officer,
right.
Like they all really respect him. And for a lot of the people, they're not going to do it if he's not going to do it.
Right. You know? And he's maybe in the worst shape of them all and the most in need of the kind of money, you know, that's hidden in this drug cartel kingpin's lair, the $75 million that they're all hoping for. He's selling crappy condos in Florida and not doing a very good job of that. And he's drinking beer in the middle of the day in his pickup truck. And he's got, you know, an ex-wife, and he's got a teenage daughter who doesn't really know him, and he's the most fleshed out of them all.
Yes,
Garrett Hedlund and Charlie Hunnam play brothers here, and until I saw them side by side playing brothers, it never occurred to me how much they look alike and how their vibe is so similar on screen. I've interviewed them both individually for different stuff I've done. I did a big cover story on Charlie Hunnam for American Way magazine a couple of years back. I sat down and had tea with Charlie Hunnam.
Yes, because King Arthur and the Lost City of Z were going to make him a big star in America.
That was his big breakout spring, allegedly. And then Garrett Hedlund and I interviewed for a show that does not exist anymore called The Vice Guide to Film, every episode was a different director. And we wouldn't talk to the director himself or herself. We would talk to people who would work with them. So I interviewed Garrett Hedlund for our Ang Lee episode because he was in Billy Flynn's long halftime walk.
Right.
And it's a really clever bit of casting to make them brothers. That's one of the inspired elements of this film.
However, it falls apart when Charlie Hunnam opens his mouth.
Yeah.
He does not do a good American accent. And by the end of the film, he's not even trying.
He's not.
Like, by the time
he's tired.
By the time they're panting in the Andes, he's just like, he sounds like Stephen Ray. It's crazy.
And then Pablo Pascal is a showier role than the rest of them. He's the pilot who lost his license for some sort of illegal... cocaine ring he was running. So there are individual moments here that are quite thrilling, because nothing, even though they're all, you know, very experienced and they have meticulously planned this heist, of course, nothing goes the way they expect it will. They can get into the place, but then they have trouble getting out. And there's a whole sequence in this helicopter, this pilfered Russian military helicopter, where they've got to figure out what to do because the money just weighs too damn much.
Yeah, and I liked how they use the sort of the physical presence of money as an object, as a sort of metaphor for their greed. Mm-hmm. You know, that which is a cool idea. And again, a lot of cool ideas here. They don't really come together. They don't add to much.
Right, and so when things go sideways and when they begin to turn on each other, which this is not a spoiler, this is what happens in this kind of movie,
of course.
You just don't care.
Right.
You just don't care if they get out of every tricky situation they're in. You don't care if they can withstand the rigors of the jungle or the mountains or, you know, the scenery is quite striking, but you don't care if they make it out of it.
Will they all die? Will none of them die?
Right. And that's a problem. Oscar Isaac cannot help but be a charismatic figure at all times. He was in Chandor's A Most Violent Year, had a much better developed character to play there, a fascinating kind of gangster, anti-hero, gangster who wants to be thought of as noble and doing
legit,
the right thing, but he can't pull himself away from the life that he's created for himself. There is vaguely such a sense of conflict here for these guys. I mean, they're basically just like, we've given everything for our country. We've gotten nothing in return. So why shouldn't we use all the skill that they gave us and use it for ourselves for once?
Right.
And that's an intriguing, morally ambiguous concept that I wish they had done a more thorough or, you know, a more searing job of exploring.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, again, I don't know if this is a case of, like, the script needed more drafts, but there's definitely, they're touching on a lot of potentially interesting ideas and making some potentially interesting statements, but then ultimately it just sort of feels like an undercooked genre exercise.
At various points in time, various actors were attached to these roles. Like, there was an early incarnation with Tom Hanks and Johnny Depp.
Oh my. I think at one point Affleck walked and was going to be replaced by Mark Wahlberg, and then he came back.
He did. And then there was a version with Tom Hardy, Channing Tatum, and Mahershala Ali.
I can't imagine Tom Hanks as any of these guys.
Yeah, I guess he's Ben Affleck.
Ben Affleck? Question mark?
I don't know. So, you know, not these guys are all talented. You know, Ben Affleck is very good in this. Yeah. He allows the hulking nature of his physical screen presence to indicate the weight of the world on him and the sadness on him. So he's very good in this. And, you know, he and Oscar Isaac, I guess, have some nice interplay. There's a woman who is the informant for the cartel who helps them set up and put the pieces in place, but she is not given a whole lot to do beyond run and look pretty.
Yeah, and she's the only woman with any dialogue in the film, pretty much.
There is somebody at the very end.
Yes, but that's about it.
And that feels like that was truncated.
Maybe so, yeah. Although there is actually a nice scene between Affleck and his daughter where he drops her off somewhere and he says, "I love you," and she just looks at him and says, "I miss you," you know, which is quite a thing to say to somebody in whose presence you are, you know. So that, like, I wanted more moments like that, you know.
They're individual moments, which does not add up. So, again, it's on Netflix. It's not terrible.
No.
I'm giving it a 5.
I'm giving it a 6. Okay. Yeah, it's noble effort from talented people. But, you know, really, go see the other 3 J.C. Chandler films. You will be thrilled.
Yes, it's at 71% on the tomato meter. And I should mention, the reason that it's called Triple Frontier is because that section where Paraguay, Brazil, and Argentina all meet, those 3 borders all meet at a bend in the river there in South America, is known as the Triple Frontier.
Well, thank you for explaining that, because I had no idea.
Las Tres Fronteras.
And it's and it's a terrible title, because I would say, oh, yeah, it's that movie. They're not words that mean anything special. I mean, you know what I mean? They don't stand out in a way. So it's like trying to remember a captive state, you know. It's adjective, noun, I don't know.
It's incredibly generic, yeah. I mean, I just happened to look it up. I'm like, Triple Frontier, what does that mean? And it's an actual place in South America, which is rather treacherous from a topographical standpoint, but also there is a lot of drug running activity going on there.
And isn't Lost City of Z sort of taking place in that same kind of
it's a hop, skip, and a jump. Oh, so at 71% from us on Triple Frontier.
No, 5.5 from us.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry. 71% at the tomato meter, 5.5 from us. We liked it less. Let's move on to a movie that's really good called Ash is Purest White. This is one of the best films of the week.
No question.
In a really random week, but it would be one of the best films in any week.
Yeah.
So this is from Zha Zhangke, Chinese director, who I'm embarrassed to say I've never seen any of his other films.
Oh, man. A Touch of Sin.
Okay.
That's my favorite.
That sounds like a Hitchcock title or Orson Welles title.
A little bit. Yeah.
So Zhao Dao, who is his wife in real life,
stars in all of his films.
Stars in all of his films, I understand. And she is just tremendous in this. It is this powerhouse performance that plays out over the course of a film that is admittedly a little long and admittedly a little slow and requires a bit of investment.
That's this guy's style. He likes a long take. He is in no hurry to get to where he's going. And there are times when I find the pace a little punishing, but I think that's probably just me as a Western film viewer and having to sort of like acclimate to his style of filmmaking. But it is worth the journey, and there are a lot of rewards to be reaped.
Yes, no, there's such a payoff to this. So Zhao Dao plays a woman who is like a gangster's moll.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah, and you see her at the beginning of the film, and she's got great swagger to her and great sassiness, and she'll grab your cigarette out of your hand and smoke it and with great flourish, and she is with this guy named Bin, played by Liao Fan, and he's not really a great gangster. He's okay. He seems like he's sort of like a middle of the road guy. He's not one of like the leaders. He's, you know, he's not like an errand boy. He's like middle of the road, kind of mediocre Chinese gangster.
He's
right?
not super ambitious, but he's mainly, he seems to be in it for the brotherhood and the loyalty.
Right. and that loyalty is important as the film goes on.
Yeah.
He has a gun that he should not have. And there's an altercation. There's a commotion. And she ends up with the gun. And she ends up firing the gun. And then she goes to prison for 5 years for the gun.
Right, because she won't say that it's his. And, you know, she does it to save his life.
Right, she protects him.
Yeah, so she goes. He goes to jail for 1 year and she gets five.
Right. And I love the way the director depicts the passage of time. Because it's not really obvious exactly what year it begins. It's not really obvious exactly what year it ends. It's not really obvious where we are along the way.
They'll work it into the dialogue, but they don't, like, hammer it home. You have to be paying attention.
Right. And so she does her time, and then she gets out, and she tries to find him. And really the bulk of the film is her journey of trying to get back on her feet and trying to establish a life for herself and just trying to just survive day to day as she searches for this man and does not know where he is or what their status is. And there is this wonderful, surreal kind of Fellini-esque nature to her adventures, whatever you want to call them, the encounters she has along the way.
Well, what's interesting about this director is that his films are, I mean, they are character pieces and they are dramas, but they're also about China and how China is changing for the better and for the worse, often for the worse, the way he depicts it. And so you get the sense that not only is this a story about this woman trying to reconnect with this man, but also the profound shift that happens between 2001 when the movie starts and 2006 when she gets out of prison, where she's trying to acclimate herself in a world that has completely been swept out under her feet. You know, these guys who were sort of somewhat gangstery higher ups for her boyfriend are now running the local chamber of commerce, you know, and like areas that used to be sort of agrarian or, you know, kind of like, you know, ramshackle. It's now these gleaming, you know, rows of high rises and stuff. And so the country is changing around her and she's just trying desperately to keep up.
But again, they don't really hammer that home.
No.
It's all very subtle. So she comes from this coal mining town.
Right.
And you see how that element of the economy and the society is kind of falling apart. Right. And things are changing as she's struggling to connect, struggling to survive. And she's a straight-up grifter in ways that, like, you're rooting for her to succeed.
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah, she's very good at it.
It's very exciting. But she's got this really placid demeanor about her. And so when she pulls off these various things she does just to, you know, get a little bit of money here and there, it's like, whoa, where did that come from? Because she's just stealthy in the way she will sneak up and she'll pull off a little crime here and there just to get by for the day. But in the midst of this struggle and in the midst of tragedy, there are these moments of just exuberant joy, whether it's a wedding that she crashes because she's starving and she needs the food, or
dancing to YMCA.
Yeah, random music and dance sequences happen all throughout this film. This very higher-up gangster has this thing for ballroom dance, and they incorporate
don't give it away.
I won't, but they incorporate ballroom dance in really unexpected places, and this is why I say that it reminds me of a Fellini film.
And
especially of something like Knights of Cabiria, where you have a plucky young woman just struggling to survive on the streets, and everywhere she goes, like, there's just weird shit happening all around her, which is it's darkly funny.
And it's a great performance, and I really was taken with, you know, this is a character where, it jumps ahead 5 years, and then it jumps ahead, like, 11 or 12 years. And she's not doing a ton of, like, makeup and hair, but there's so much else going on that indicates that time has passed, that this character is aging, that this woman is changing, that's so subtle and so effective. I think it's the kind of thing where it would have been really just to, like, you know, slap some gray hairs in there or whatever, but she's not doing any of that stuff. And yet you totally get what she's doing and how she's changing. The relationship with this guy that she's pursuing is so sort of like on again and off again, and they're even when it's clear that it has no future, like they still can't ever quite separate from each other either, you know. But there is this whole sort of underlying thing, and again, it the more you, of these movies of the from this director that you see, you know, this is an ongoing theme from him. This is very much a movie about a changing China and about, mm-hmm. You know, the sort of the slow embrace of capitalism and how it changes the landscape and, you know, everything that this woman came to know and is trying to figure out how to, you know, adjust to.
Right. So he gets his arms around this giant topic in this very intimate way.
Yes.
He will, yeah, as you say, he likes his long takes, and there is one scene in particular in a hotel room.
Yes.
Between the two of them, between is it Zhao and Bin.
Right.
And it's just like watching the balance of power change over and over again, and you realize after a while, oh, he hasn't cut. This is all one long take.
Yeah.
And so I really admire the patience of that and then the performances that he allows to flourish within that kind of setting. So, yeah, I dug it. I'm giving it an 8.8.
Yeah, I said 8.5. Again, like not my favorite of his movies. I think A Touch of Sin is still my number one. And if you've not seen it, I recommend that you do. But if you've never seen a Zhao Zhangke movie, Ash is Purest White is as good a place to start as any. So
there
check it out.
98% on the tomato.
Excellent.
Okay, let's move on to a movie that's not good. It's called The Aftermath.
Oh, brother.
And not unlike our first film we discussed, Triple Frontier, this has a really good cast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the pieces would seem to be in place for a good movie here. So this takes place right after World War II. The aftermath of World War II.
Like months after the end of World War II.
You might say, yes. And so Keira Knightley is reunited with her husband, played by Jason Clarke. He is a British Army officer. They are in Hamburg. He has been sent to Hamburg to help with
reconstruction. Exactly. Like there's still rubble everywhere. They're still digging bodies out of, you know, like crumbled buildings.
Yeah.
It is like right after the end of the war.
And they, because he is a British officer, he is allowed to move in to this beautiful palatial home owned by Alexander Skarsgård, who is a German architect living there with his teenage daughter. And it's initially about the tension of that. These Brits moving into this German man's home. He has nowhere to go, although he's, you know, clearly very educated, very cultured, would seem to be very useful in society, but he's German. And there is the question as to whether he was ever actually a Nazi.
Exactly.
Which has made his prospects rather limited.
He and his daughter are supposed to be sent to a relocation camp, and Jason Clarke says, no, just you can stay here, just like go live in the attic.
They go and they live in the attic, but Keira Knightley is sort of disgusted and appalled by him. She assumes that he must have been a Nazi, and she wants nothing to do with him at all, and so there is tension.
Mm.
There's great tension. It's very fraught from the very start. And
her marriage to Jason Clarke obviously has had problems. There's a certain lack of passion and lack of communication between the two of them for reasons that we come to understand.
Right. There's a distance, and when they do try to connect, it's a little awkward, it's a little forced, it feels unnatural, it feels inauthentic, and they're always interrupted because there's always some kind of emergency that he has to go tend to.
Exactly.
And so the work there is always priority number one. And so she's banging around this big old house by herself with nothing to do, and the staff clearly resents her, mm-hmm. and understandably so. But slowly but surely, she and the hunky architect get to know each other and find that maybe they don't hate each other after all. And then she is in this this tricky love triangle between her and Jason Clarke and Alexander Skarsgård. And just like the way each man is drawn, like it seems so obvious as to what should happen here, right? Like Jason Clarke he's all business. He's distant. Like that marriage seems to just be no longer even a viable prospect. And here's like hunky,
widowed.
He's an architect, but you also see him chopping wood. He likes opera.
There is literally a scene where she looks out the window at him chopping wood.
Right, but also like he plays opera, and he'll turn the gramophone thingy out to the hallway so she can hear the opera. So he's like perfect.
Yeah,
and he looks like Alexander Skarsgård. So
exactly.
How do you say no to any of this? There is, so they have a decent decent amount of chemistry with each other. Sure. I would say she and Jason Clark have zero. Like, that is ice cold, and so you never really understand what that bond was about. The clothes are great.
Yeah, I was saying, if you're the kind of person who goes to a 40s or 30s period piece for the handbags, you'll get your fill.
There's a lot of really cute little sweaters and skirts that she wears.
Yes.
There's this one dress that she wears on a very emotional climactic night. Mm-hmm. This yellow kind of silky halter neck number with this, it's got a low back. Yeah. It reminded me of the famous dress that Keira Knightley wore in Atonement.
Oh, kind of.
The green dress.
Yes, this is more mustardy.
That allowed her her shoulder blades to just jut out of her back like knives. And so, I mean, there is that. It's all, like, handsomely appointed. It's very safe and tasteful. It's just really dull.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is, I think they had various routes they could have taken. They could have gone, like, pure full-on soap opera and just made it about, like, you know, a dissatisfied housewife meets, you know, hunky German architect. They could have, you know, leaned into the historical aspect of, like, you know, the horrors of, you know, post-war Germany and how they hadn't completely sort of stamped out, you know, the Hitler supporters and stuff. And then there's also, like, the kind of, you know, let's look at history and war through the refraction of emotions and, you know, what the war cost, you know, all these people and who they lost and how that affected them and how it affected this marriage and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And the movie sort of tries to do a little of all of those things, but it winds up not doing any of them all that well.
This is directed by James Kent, who has done a lot of television, but also did, and I think I saw this, Alonzo, Testament of Youth.
I did not see that one.
With Alicia Vikander and Kit Harington and Taron Egerton. Also a World War One movie. Yeah. It checks all the boxes from a technical perspective. Like, it's handsome. Like, it's solidly made. It's just, I wish it took some, it picked a lane. I wish it took some chances.
Exactly. You know, Robert Abley reviewed it for me at The Wrap, and he talked about how, you know, there's actually kind of a genre of these sort of post-war movies, you know, that sort of examine the ethics and the complications of, you know, the end of Nazism and the emergence of the new Europe or whatever. You know, like The Marriage of Maria Braun or A Foreign Affair, that Billy Wilder movie, or even Phoenix from a couple of years ago. But that this movie doesn't really, like, dare to make any kind of statement the way those did.
No, it wants to be more of like a romance, a torrid romance.
And if they had just stuck with that and just sort of used the war stuff as a background, great. But then if you're also going to have like grisly images of like burned out bodies found in rubble, so I was like, well, that's not really going with your whole, like, you know, T-sets and twin sets, you know.
People get shot. So I am saying a 4.
I mean, I said a 6.2 just because for the handsomeness, you know, but it is a bit of a slog.
All right, so 5.1 is our number. It's at 27% on the tomato meter. So I don't know if it's that bad, but it's probably like a whole lot of like 2-star reviews.
The highlight of my experience was seeing the teaser trailer for Downton Abbey.
Oh, how does it look?
For the movie. Well, they don't show you anybody, but they do this sort of, like, I don't know if it's a drone or a crane or a helicopter shot, like, up the side of the building and above it, which they never did on TV. So it's like, ooh, this is going to be the movie of the TV show.
You know, so. So you're excited.
Oh, totally. You still have time to catch up with all 7 seasons or whatever.
I do, just right after I get done watching all those Game of Thrones seasons that we never saw.
Oh,
so
man.
We are going to do Game of Thrones, by the way. You guys.
Not me, but someone.
But no, you're not going to watch the new ones even?
I think there's no way I would understand what was going on.
That's the fun of it. That's why we got
to
do it.
I used to sit in the TYT studio and listen to them recap that show, and I had no idea what they were talking about. Like, I could listen to you recap pretty much any show, any other show on television, and at least have some idea of what's being discussed. Yeah. But this was just like, it was all in another language.
The mythology is dense. Let's move on to our last movie. Then we're going to do a little bit of movie news after this, because there's news to be had. The movie is called Sorry Angel, and Alonzo will tell us about it.
This is a new French film from director Christophe Honoré, who did Love Songs, and did he do Dans Paris? Is that him? Or I can never keep all these folks
straight. We're going to look it up.
He is, yes, he is the Dom Parry guy, which is one that Dave really likes a lot. Anyway, so this is a period piece set in the 80s.
I think it's the early 90s.
Oh, you're right. Sorry, 1990, actually. My bad. And it is about an older writer, and he meets a young student, and they commence an affair, but you know they have a lot of things not in common. The younger man is from a small town. He is HIV negative, whereas the writer is has seroconverted. And you know it's 1990, so AIDS is still a thing in terms of you know we haven't come around to the protease inhibitor cocktail yet, so people are dying, and it's a sort of fraught relationship, but at the same time, obviously, they see a lot in each other and provide each other with a lot of opportunity for growth and for understanding. And so it is, you know, it swirls around again, I think what The Aftermath wants to do, it swirls around a tempestuous period of history, but it looks at it through a very intimate lens.
This was a very romantic movie and a very realistic movie at the same time. I love the way it shot. There's like a dreaminess to, you know, just walking through the streets of Paris at night, or just the, you know, the moments when these two gentlemen are apart, but they envision being together. There's like a dreamy kind of wistful intimacy to a lot of the imagery here.
And also the places where people are publicly cruising each other, which is a thing that still happens, but you know, it's sort of, you know, the app has kind of destroyed that in a lot of ways.
Grindr.
Very much so. Yeah. Le Grindr. It is presented in an almost sort of ethereal kind of way.
Yeah. So this reminded me of Call Me By Your Name.
Okay, why?
Because there is an age difference between them, and not more so here.
Sure, yeah.
But there are some images of them with like the blue sky behind them. You know, there's a scene toward the end where the young man has come to see him in Paris, and they're sort of like nuzzling each other, and it's springtime, and everything seems possible, although clearly it cannot be. They cannot be together. And just the blue sky behind them just reminded me of that, the signature image from the posters in Call Me By Your Name.
Yeah.
Just the idea that, you know, they're at really different places in their lives, but there is still this connection that they can't deny.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's one of those great things of the movies, like those sort of those love stories that, you know, it's not going to be a forever thing, but it is this moment of, like, passion and of, you know, what Cole Porter would call too hot not to cool down. You know?
And also the guy, Vincent Lacoste, who is the young actor playing, Arthur is his name.
Yeah.
He's really idealistic. Like he's young and just in the beginning stages of being out. He has a kind of a girlfriend at the beginning of the film, but he's dating guys and he falls in love with this older man. And there's such idealism to him about the way gay should be.
Oh, like, look, I totally related to this character in 1990. The idea that he comes from the sticks and visits Paris, and the first thing he wants to do is go to an ACT UP meeting because that's what's happening in the big city. I was like, oh man, I've been there. I've been you.
He wants to go to the ACT UP meeting, but also he's like, why shouldn't people have sex in the toilets? Like, who cares if it smells like pee? That's exciting, you know? But meanwhile, the two older guys who were sitting on the couch with him, they've lost friends. They've lost loved ones. Yeah. You know, he's sick himself. Jacques is sick himself, you know? And that conflict, like there's a melancholy nature to the different parts of their life that they are in, and it makes you realize, like, yeah, this really is not going to work.
Of course, yeah. And even if, I think, if AIDS weren't the issue there, just the being older, you know, and looking at the world in a different way and being like, yeah, that was cute then, but now it's exhausting or whatever, you know. I think this is a really smart movie about generations and about, you know, I love that we're in this period where we can start telling more stories about the worst years of the AIDS epidemic, that we now have enough of a distance where we can kind of treat that as a period.
Because you have seen many, many, many movies about AIDS in your life.
I have indeed. But I think there's been a really interesting sort of renaissance of that lately, because, I mean, I've seen a lot of documentaries. As far as dealing with it dramatically from a distance in the last couple of years, we've had 1985 and BPM and a lot of really good movies that kind of go into it. And, you know, and I sort of, I came out at the end of that period. I came out in like 1988. So I missed like the worst of it. And I didn't, you know, people I know who are like 5-10 years older than me did that whole thing of like, yes, everyone I knew died, you know, so I thankfully didn't have to endure all of that. But, you know, it was this moment where this stuff was happening and people were terrified and you didn't know what life was going to hold in store for you, if anything. And you were trying to figure out how to fight back and how to, you know, respond to, you know, the governmental crisis and, you know, it certainly colored every aspect of just being a gay person. I mean, like, you know, I was visiting with my sisters and we talked about how when I came out to my dad, who was a doctor, I think like all we talked about for the first 3 years was AIDS, because that was the only thing he had to relate it to. Like, all he knew about gay was you get AIDS and die, you know? And so.
So was he fearful that was going to happen to
you? Oh, totally. Yeah. And so, you know, but that was just what things were like then. And so as for those of us who remember it, and then obviously for all the people younger than me who completely missed it, you know, it's important that these films exist as kind of a reminder of like, yeah, this is where we were. And now thankfully we're not.
Yeah. No, the Arthur character is like, you know, how young gay men might be now who did not lose friends and don't know what it was like. And he's all idealistic about how things should be. And it's like, nope. There's a great snappiness to the dialogue, and not unlike Ash's Purest White, this director will hold a shot for quite a long time. So there's one overhead shot of Jacques, and I believe it's a former lover of his who is very sick.
Yeah.
And they're just holding each other in the bathtub in this tight, cramped, uncomfortable bathtub where the water is getting colder, and he just holds that shot of the two of them. And there's such intimacy, and there's such an organic nature to the way that they interact with each other.
Yeah.
You truly feel like you're eavesdropping on something intimate and precious, you know, these moments that they have with each other. This movie is not mawkish or sanctimonious. And you know, I clearly have not seen as many films about this topic as you have, being an Outfest programmer, but you know, sometimes there can be kind of a sanctimonious, kind of mawkish nature to watching that kind of loss. And that's not true here at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think in general, movies about death, whether it's cancer or, you know, car accidents or whatever, you know, can sort of play on a very easy sentimentality because, you know, you want to make an audience cry, kill a character they like, you know, and you can do that really sort of desultorily sometimes, and it's kind of a cheat. But yeah, this movie in no way traffics in that kind of thing.
Yeah, the Jacques character is a very matter of fact about, you know, what lies ahead for him. And,
yes.
And I admire the way they treat all these characters. So I'm saying 8.
I also said 8.
Our number is an 8. It's an 87% on the tomato meter. Sorry Angel.
It is making its way around the country. So it's opening today in Los Angeles. But if it hasn't come to you yet, keep an eye out.
Yes. Let's do a little bit of movie news, and we're going to have a bit of a shorter show for you this week. Not a lot of movies, and it's just the two of us here. And Alonzo is going to hack up a lung if I keep making him talk. We've got a big pile of Ricola throat lozenges just waiting for him, so hopefully he'll be feeling
better. I'm trying not to do it too much on the mic, you know.
I appreciate that. Our listeners appreciate that. So some news, which is not necessarily movie news, but it's just news, which everyone is talking about, and that is this crazy college admissions scandal where there was this whole ring of lies and bribes and really terrible behavior by rich white people to get their kids into USC and Georgetown and Yale. And I won't go through the whole spiel, but people basically faked that their kids were like athletes, you know, and or
sorry.
It's okay. And faked that they had amazing SAT scores by paying somebody else to take the test for them, or by paying to have a proctor in the room who was on the take, who let them have more time, or whatever it was. And so caught up in this are two actresses. And we keep saying actresses, but William H. Macy was totally in on this, not charged.
Apparently he was not charged. So I don't, you know, and again, his not being in on it could just be the sort of thing where, like, our daughter's going to college, you deal with it, Mom.
There is some transcript of some phone call or email that he is on. So anyway, he knew something. But but Felicity Huffman and Lori Loughlin are the two very famous faces of this hilarious and insane and chutzpah-filled scandal. So Lori Loughlin, you know, was a major Hallmark Channel star, which is why I had to talk about this with Alonzo today.
Of course. Yeah. So Hallmark Channel has cut off all ties with her, which is pretty huge because she is definitely one of their big stars. Not only a, you know, reliable presence during the Christmas season, But she does the garage sale mysteries.
What is that?
So Hallmark, there's two Hallmark channels. There's Hallmark and there's Hallmark Movies and Mysteries. And Movies and Mysteries, a lot of it is sort of reruns of, you know, Murder, She Wrote and Psych and, you know, Columbo. But they also do these originals. And there's like, you know, the Aurora Tea Garden mysteries where Candace Cameron Bure plays a librarian. there was ones with like the a contractor mystery with like Jewel as a contractor. There's, you know, the morning show mysteries with Holly Robinson Pete, and then garage sale mysteries was Lori Loughlin's thing, and she plays like an antiques dealer who's always like finding things that wind up being clues to crimes that she then has to solve. My favorite was when Allison Sweeney did the Murder She Baked series a baker, but they stopped doing those.
Have you seen all of these?
No.
Okay, but you know of them.
I know of them.
They're oeuvre. Yeah.
Exactly. I'm aware that they're in the universe. And she also stars on the Hallmark Channel's highest rated series, a show called When Calls the Heart.
Which is a terrible title, by the way.
It's a terrible show. It's a show for people that thought Little House on the Prairie was too edgy. It's about like Canadian settlers in the 19th century, but like there's no, somebody's saying on Twitter, there's no effort to like make anybody's hair or makeup or wardrobe look not 21st century. Yeah, but she plays the mayor of the town, so
it's a big job. It's a good part.
It is. Like, I mean, but they've already like, you know, changed the header on the Facebook page to erase her.
Wow.
So yeah, I don't know if the mayor's gonna have a tragic moose accident or what, but out she goes, apparently.
A recall election. So,
but I mean, the weird thing though is like, you know, yeah, we're enjoying the fact that it's these two actresses and it's just the whole thing is so bananas, but obviously this goes way deeper and there's many much more powerful moneyed interests involved.
It just speaks to like the corruption of the whole college admissions process in general.
Exactly.
If coaches are on the take, you know, the water polo coach at USC who was like legendary and already made like $500,000 a year.
Oh boy.
He was on the take. You know, it's a sailing coach at Stanford, the women's soccer coach at Harvard, I want to say.
Yeah. And you know, and the thing is what a lot of people are saying is like, well,
or Yale, sorry. Yeah.
Why don't they just do this the way that normal rich people do and, like, you know, buy a library or whatever? Because, you know, Jared Kushner's dad gave $2.5 million to Harvard. Trump gave very large sums of money to Wharton around the time that Donald Jr. and Ivanka were applying there. So, you know, there is this sort of understood level of largesse that rich white people get to have, and so this is somehow like the tacky version. You know, they didn't go through channels, and so now it's technically fraud. But I hope that it brings up larger issues about the fact that like there are people in prison who for faking their address to try and get their kids into better public schools,
right.
And they did that because, you know, rich white people like to create these neighborhood enclaves where, you know, Highland Park in Dallas immediately leapt to mind, you know, where like their property taxes pay for a really nice public school that only their kids can go to because only their kids can live in those,
right,
you know, city limits or whatever. So the whole system is rigged anyway. The idea that you would then rig the system to go to USC seems crazy.
Like, since when is USC that hard to get into? Like, they spent... So Lori Loughlin and her husband, Massimo, from the Target Massimo brand.
Line, yes.
So they spent $500,000
yes,
on the bribery section of getting their daughters into USC. It does not even cost that much to go to USC.
No, and how, I mean, how do you, if you're the kids of Felicity Huffman and William H. Macy, how completely uninteresting and dumb do you have to be to, right, not be of interest to colleges? Like, it seems to me that that's your in already anyway.
Right. And you can go to, I mean, I guess what it is that the parents want the bragging rights to be able to say, oh, my daughter goes to such and such or whatever it is.
I guess.
So much so that, like, we're going to Photoshop her face onto a water polo player.
Exactly.
Or whatever.
Well, and you know, Lori Loughlin's daughter, who's the
Olivia Jade.
Yeah, she's this, like, online influencer, had done a YouTube video not long ago basically saying that she was going to college for the tailgate parties and didn't care about, you know, schooling. So that didn't help. And then on top of it, you know, as Kara pointed out on Keep It, it's like, she's already got this career as right. this sort of YouTube media person. Like, you know, she, as mom got cut off by Hallmark, she got cut off by Sephora. It's sort of like, why even go to college if you're already rich and privileged and you have a career going?
I wonder that too. Like, she already had a gig going, and my only guess is that from a really cynical perspective, they thought, we're going to send you to college to have you cash in on that whole, like, adorable college girl Maybe. Part of the total sham of being an influencer, because pretty soon after she's like, I love my college life. Thanks to Amazon Smile for delivering all the stuff I need for my dorm room. Like, so she was able to like then parlay that into a whole other realm of, you know, whoring her Instagram page out to corporations. So it is kind of mind boggling.
So yeah, I mean, as much as fun as it is to sort of talk about Aunt Becky, I think like what this really exposes is, yeah, a system that totally doesn't work and that, you know, I would like to think that this would inspire some institutional changes, but it will not.
But probably not.
No,
right.
Of course not.
We got into our fine institutions all on our own.
I mean, I was a solidly Gen Xer, so I think it was a little easier because I think the boomers opened up a lot of slots and we then couldn't entirely fill in. I don't know. I got into the same college my sister was going to at the time. Maybe that was it. I don't know.
I don't know. My school wasn't that hard to get into back when I got into it. SMU was not a hard school to get into, but now I think it might be. I don't know.
Everything's hard. Yeah. Now the millennials, there's like, again, that was the whole thing about Gen X. We were like a bit of a population dip. Mm-hmm. So, you know, once the boomers started having babies that started going to college, yeah, it got crazy competitive. And, like, I know I had two nieces that went to the University of Georgia, which was super easy to get into when I was in high school. But now it's free. It's, like, paid for by, like, the lottery or whatever. Oh. And so it's super competitive and really hard to get into, and people want to go there, and it's a much better school, apparently. So, yeah, we definitely were in a window of, like, I mean, not that it was a cakewalk to, you know, Harvard said no, but, you know.
Did you apply to Harvard?
I did. I had two brothers that went there. I thought, why not?
Where else did you apply? You went to Vanderbilt. Where else did you apply?
I got turned down by some of the best universities in the country. I didn't get into Northwestern. I didn't get into Georgetown. Those ones I remember.
But did you apply to all private schools?
I applied to University of Georgia and got in, and that was sort of my backup. But I didn't really want to go there because that's where most of the people in my high school class were going.
You wanted to get out of Atlanta.
I just didn't really want to see the people in my high school class anymore. I went to Vanderbilt.
Well, I applied to all schools out of state as well because everyone I knew was going to UCLA and USC and Santa Barbara and San Diego, and I wanted to find out who I was on my own. So I applied to and got into only four schools, SMU where I went, Marist College in Poughkeepsie, New York, where my father went.
Okay.
George Washington, because they had a political journalism program that I thought I wanted to do. And then Syracuse, because I thought I wanted to be a TV news anchor.
Well.
And that's where they pump out anchors. And so I'm glad things turned out the way they did. But yeah, it wouldn't even have occurred to me or my parents to like bribe the rowing coach.
No, heavens
it's just
no.
Bizarre. It's just all bizarre.
You picked the one with the mildest winter, so well
That's
done.
That's exactly why I went there, because I went to some orientation for Syracuse, and they showed kids trudging through, like, knee-deep snow to get to class, and I'm like, screw that. I'm going to go to Dallas, where everyone's nice, where we have humidity. So the other little bit of movie news is that James Gunn is back as the director of the third Guardians of the Galaxy movie.
Now, I just saw the headline on this, because a friend of mine sent it to me. So Disney just decided all is forgiven.
Yep. I think it was that letter writing campaign that Chris Pratt and Bradley Cooper started.
Dave Bautista said, like, well, without him, I'm not coming back.
Yeah.
So I don't know about Pratt, but I'm sure a lot of the other cast probably like stood in union for that. So now he's going to get to double dip and do Suicide Squad 2 and Guardians 3.
He is.
Fascinating.
That's a lot of work for one person, but you know, a lot of the tone of those movies was, you know, set by him, and I love the humor of those films and the friskiness of them, and I feel like that has a lot to do with him, and so we should remind folks the reason why he was fired from the third Guardians movie is because there was a bunch of old tweets from like 7 or 8 years ago that were, I guess, kind of bad jokes.
They were jokes about pedophilia. And not that anyone ever said that he was a pedophile or ever defended it. They were clearly just like lame attempts to be shocking.
Dark humor.
Yeah. And so some right-wing concern trolls highlighted them because they were mad at stuff that he had been tweeting about the president. And Disney just
caved
and canned him. And a lot of people were upset about that, but they seemed like they were not going to budge. So he accepted an offer across town from Warner Brothers to go direct Suicide Squad 2. And I guess now Disney folded, which is interesting that it's happening now with Disney taking over Fox.
Right.
I don't know if those two things are related or not.
So when are these movies supposed to come out? Like, is he going to be, like, jumping back and forth between various, like, sound stages in Los Angeles?
Well, I don't know if Guardians 3 even has, like, well, I don't know. Maybe it does. I forgot. All of those Marvel movies usually have, like, a very long, you know, setup and date set.
I'm looking at IMDb, and there's no date yet. It just says pre-production for Guardians. So we'll have to...
Suicide Squad 2, I think, is coming out in 2020?
Yeah.
But, yeah, so, I mean, and it's not that it's been unprecedented for people to hop back and forth, because obviously Joss Whedon, after doing two Avengers movies, went over and did all the additional photography on Justice League after Zack Snyder had to pull out. Suicide Squad 2 is called The Suicide Squad.
It's a totally different movie from Suicide Squad.
And it's coming out August 6th, 2021 at this
point. Okay, all right. So it does take years and years to make these films. So we'll keep following this. But yeah, this is news that just broke in the last couple of hours that James Gunn is back, which is a good thing.
I think so, yeah, because I do like what he's done to those movies. And there is a specific directorial tone at play here that it would be hard to replicate. Although those characters obviously did emerge in Avengers Infinity War, but
yes. So that is it for us this week. Kind of a random week, but next week Us comes out.
Ooh.
I'm really excited about Us. Us premiered at South by Southwest, and it just played like absolute gangbusters. So that is the biggie of next week. So we'll for sure do that. And I'd like to play catch up with the Mustang if we can. Maybe we can see 5 feet apart if we can. I've seen it. It's a beautiful dying teen movie.
Is the movie beautiful or the teens?
The teens are beautiful.
Okay.
And they're dying. And their teens.
Just to be clear.
Right. So anyway, so thank you for sticking around. We will have more people next time. We will have video next time so you can see our gorgeous faces. But thank you for hanging out with us.
Yes. If you're watching on YouTube, like and subscribe. And if you're listening to this as a podcast, leave us positive feedback. And you can get this as a podcast in all the places where podcasts live, Stitcher and Spotify and you name it. Go find it. You can follow us at BeFastAllDay on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.
We are in all of those places, and we will respond to you if you write things to us.
We sure will.
And also, coming out this weekend is it, or maybe on Monday, Sunday or Monday, my latest a la carte interview with Tracy Wells, who played the daughter on Mr. Belvedere for 6 seasons.
Okay.
We talk about her and her career and hanging out with, she worked with Kirk Cameron, Ricky Schroeder, and Alfonso Ribeiro, and she was in one of the Michael Jackson Pepsi commercials.
Oh, wow.
We talk about him and also about the documentary. Yeah, we talk about that as well.
Interesting.
Yeah, so my latest interview will be up very soon. Thank you for listening and watching, and we'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.